season, I guess.
Yeah.
Hard to market because it's sort of a bond crossover.
Well, it's kind of nice that you ritualized it with the school thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, good food.
Mm-hmm. Huh?
And good food, yeah.
And good food.
Food.
The school lunch food.
Yeah,
food.
Yeah.
I see we have 30 people coming in today, so our population will grow a little bit.
30?
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Now, is Elder Hostel next week?
Yeah.
Now, are these people coming in for
I don't think so. I think they're...
I'm so sorry. Okay, well, let's just start with a moment of silence. And if you all turn to Psalm 63, let's have a moment of silence. And then, grab a Bible on your way. Oh, there's a pile there on the chair. Take a moment of silence and then 3 minutes of silence, and then I'll start us in prayer, and we'll just dive right in. If I can find Psalm 63, there we go. And we'll read the psalm together. We'll just read it collectively. Oh God, you are my
God.
I seek you. My soul thirsts for you.
My flesh faints for you.
As in a dry and weary land where there is no water.
So I looked upon you in the sanctuary, beholding your power and glory.
Because
your steadfast love is better than life, my lips will praise you. So I will bless you as long as I live. I will lift up my hands and call on your name.
My soul is satisfied as with a rich feast,
and my mouth praises you with joyful lips. When I think of you on my bed, and meditate on you in the watches of the night, for you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I will sing for joy. My soul clings to you, your right hand upholds me, but those who seek to destroy my life shall go down into the depths of the earth. They shall be given over to the power of the sword.
They shall be prey for jackals.
But the king shall rejoice in God. All who swear by him shall exult. For the mouths of the liars will be stopped.
Gracious God, you enter our world not because you are flattered by our sweet names for you. May you enter this world still so broken, where you inhabit our table and bread, hope rent garments still bloody by your being uprooted so ungraciously from this earth. You come to us not beguiled by our entreaties, but captured already and soon yet to be by our flesh. You sway over us like stars that dust dark night. Profile half hidden in the shadowed moon, and you tell us that now there is no farewell, no leave taking. That this promise is almost unbearable in its mass, its edges too sharp, and all of it yet to be still seems too light for our alabaster realities. Come now into our midst, Lord Jesus. Okay, how many people are fans of Stephen Colbert?
Yeah.
Does anyone not know of him? I mean, it's something, I don't know how many people, like, is there a TV up here?
Oh, no. So, yeah, this is a prime one.
What's that? No, you can't, you probably, I'm just wondering, you know, like if you're up here, like, well, what do you like about Stephen? What makes Stephen Colbert so great?
His hair.
His hair. It's true.
That's true. He has great hair. I never thought about it.
selling point.
He's got the quickest mind.
Yeah.
He has the quickest mind.
He does. He's so sharp. And what does he do to our culture? And what does he do and what he
mocks it.
Huh?
He mocks it.
Yeah. He takes what we believe. I mean, I would love to have Mike, the philosopher, here, because he takes what we believe. I think he's doing a session on that this afternoon. But he takes what we believe to be true and then turns it over and sort of exposes other truths by, you know, through satire. Well, I absolutely, well, I'm not the only one that believes this. I got this from David Fredrickson, but he, as I've watched Stephen Colbert lately, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like St. Paul. This is just like what St. Paul does. Because the problem with St. Paul so many times is that he'll take, he does these arguments where he starts out with something that we all assume to be true, and then he argues a complicated, you know, a complicated kind of clever argument out, and then undoes what, and actually reverses the original truth. And that's why it's so hard to preach on pericopes or take Paul out of context. Because you're often, if you take Paul out of context, you're often taking, making the very argument, trying to claim that as your basis, is that he's trying to, you know, eventually argue against. I think that happens in Romans a lot. But today we're going to look at 1 Corinthians because it's short. And we all, most people know it, and we've always been at weddings. How many people here are clergy? I know, 1, 2, 3, count. You count. But everyone wants 1 Corinthians as their text, and I know.
Sorry.
No, it's true. It's completely, utterly different from what, so today we're going to do a little bit more teaching then. So turn to 1 Corinthians 13. It's a pretty short chapter. And we'll read through it. And then we'll go back and talk to you about what Paul is ripping on. Okay, I'll just read it for the sake of, you know, just kind of keep saying. If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. Do you know how his sentence structures are here? And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and I have all faith, so if you move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions and if I hand over my body so that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient, love is kind, love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoings, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. But as for prophecies, they will come to an end. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will come to an end. For we know only in part, and we prophesy only in part, but when the complete comes, the partial will come to an end. When I was a child, I spoke like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became an adult, I put an end to childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then we will see face to face. Now I know only in part, then I will know fully, even as I have been fully known. And now faith, hope, and love abide. These three, and the greatest of these is love. How have you typically... I'm just going to throw it open. And if you don't have a Bible, grab one over there. There's some over here. We're just using the Bible because I don't always paper printing up stuff. Yeah. Sorry about that. How have you quickly understood this text. How do you learned it?
I typically understood it as good for weddings, but when you just spoke, when I was studying philosophy, there was a difficult passage in Aristotle that they just threw out to us undergraduates, and it was about the workings of the universe, and none of us got it, and the professor finally told us that the movement of the universe was accomplished by law. And I see this in that, and that in, I see that in this passage now, that and in a love between people, that kind of love isn't possible.
Nice. Anyone else?
I remember it being taught, to me sort of as a goal or an ideal.
Yeah. And Captain Hook with the mommy.
Actually, you know, well, I will bring us back to that. That's a good point, because I can bring us back to that. That's pretty smart stuff. Going back to Stephen Colbert, what if you took Stephen Colbert 2,000 years into the future and read him? What would you think he was talking about?
2,000 years from now?
2,000 years from now. It's time travel. Woo! 2,000 years in the future. Robots will do all the work. What would you think, Stephen? You found all scripts of Stephen Colbert, and what would you think he was talking about?
Misunderstood, people don't understand the context.
Exactly. He would be read to be saying almost the opposite of what he's trying to communicate, right? Because we get the joke. We get the context. We know.
And his tone.
Huh?
His tone does
his
so
His tone
much.
Of voice, yeah. So let me read to you now. I'm going to read to you a letter from a military poet, and I have this Tyre Teotos. It doesn't sound anything like it spells. I had to like write it out. But Tyre Teotos wrote a poem, because remember, at this time, the Roman Empire was still the dominant force in the culture. And they would send off young soldiers, and there were no guns then, so everything was hand-to-hand combat. So what would inspire military soldiers, especially young men, 16, 17, 18 years old, to have the courage to kill in battle? And so a 40-year-old man, probably, you know, however tired Tomatoes is, wrote this poem to tell these young men that the greatest thing in the world is virtue. And how you attain that virtue is to be able to look your opponent in the eye, stab them in the heart, and then twist it. And that is how you, that is the greatest of all things. So I'm going to read a portion of this. And it's an ancient hymn to virtue. I would neither call a man to mind, nor put him in my tale for prowess. Not even had he the stature and strength of a Cyclops, or surpassed in swiftness the Thracian north wind, or were comelier man than Tithonus, or a richer man than Midas, or had dastrous suaveness of tongue. For a man is not good in war if he had not endured the sight of bloodly slaughter, and stood close and reached forth to kill the foe. This is virtue. This is the noblest prize and the fairest. Can you see, can you hear the patterns of language? And can you see how Paul is taking this ancient military poem that was contemporary to his day and riffing and taking Christ's love? I'm just kind of like taking all the stuff and then overturning it. Was that, I mean, yeah. Paul does this all the time. He does this all the time. But because we don't know this ancient military poem, we don't understand the radicality of 1 Corinthians. And so we kind of sentimentalize it and just use it for weddings. Any thoughts?
Can you read it again?
Yeah.
Sure can. You know what I have trouble with? The names, because they're like really big. I mean, they're like, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. So if you, okay. I know Midas. Like, everyone knows that from the tire company. But I mean, that's a one contextual kind of, or, you know. I would neither call a man to mind nor put him in my tale for prowess. This is a longer poem. Not even had he the stature and strength of a cyclops, or surpassed in swiftness the Thracian north wind, or were a comelier man than Tithonus, or a richer man than Midas, or had a Drastus suaveness of tongue. You can think here of like speaking in tongues and, you know, all those. And then the last verses and now faith, hope, and love abide. For a man is not good in war if he had not endured the sight of bloodly slaughter and stood close and reached forth to kill the foe. This is the noblest prize and the fairest. This is virtue.
So these kind of rhapsodic poem to kind of virtue, that was a kind of a common form of the day.
Yeah, it was used to, because, you know, they didn't have like great military ads like on TV where the, you know, like the military men are falling down ropes and, you know, they're doing like helicopters, and so they didn't have this like, you know, what's the slogan for the army that's like, you know. What's that?
We be all you can be.
All that stuff. Yeah. So they didn't have that, and so this poem would be passed out to young soldiers to inspire them to be able to go into battle, and you know, and because this was the empire, you know, and they would have to, you know, have some kind of thing to make them courageous. So. And know what virtue was, and virtue is going into a bloody slaughter and being able to stab your opponent and kill them.
But at the time that these young people were reading that, they hadn't done that yet. Maybe they hadn't done that, so
maybe
they had. As in that poem was trying to motivate them, so when the battle time came, that they would be striving for this virtue that they hadn't been exposed. They hadn't seen the bloody field. They hadn't. Maybe, perhaps, there's some that
right.
Maybe Paul's saying, you haven't even seen love. You haven't even,
yes.
You haven't even seen what I'm trying to tell you. But
you should
strive for it, you know, or
exactly,
sort
yeah.
of similar. Because what that poem is saying might not be attainable for some people. They won't be in the middle of it. They won't be. I don't know, they're not. It seems like this is also not attainable. The kind of love, he's more pointing out that we don't know. And if you were reading that and you hadn't gone into battle, you realize, well, I don't have virtue yet. I haven't done that yet. You know, I haven't gone and looked at the eye of my foe yet. If I was in training soldier.
And I'm scared to death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah.
And I'm a new Christian. I haven't loved people like that. And I haven't. And I don't know where to go forward from there.
And Paul and his first communities, exactly what you're getting at, is Paul and his first communities, they thought Jesus was coming back soon. And so they're still living with these broken communities. And we know how Acts goes. I mean, you know, it's all like good, and they shared with everyone, and then things just fall apart. And so on these first, they're like waiting, and they're, and, you know, I don't know if you know the Tikkun, the mending of creation, they're still waiting that peace that where you know God's love will finally triumph, and but they're still living within this brokenness of these communities. And First Corinthians Corinth was for those of you who might not know, it's sort of like New Orleans. It was like doing a mission church in New Orleans around Bourbon Street. And because it was a port city and a very active one, and there are all different kinds of people there, and there are all different kinds of churches there, but they probably would have been aware of this poem. They probably would, because it was passed around all the time. It was something that, you know, for their pop, or you know, their popular culture, it would have been. And so when Paul takes this and says, like, and turns it all over, it's just like, yeah. Other thoughts?
Getting back to what was said earlier, as far as it being ideal, it's the thing that I always kind of, I mean, it sounds so good, 1 Corinthians 13, but it's just, has always impressed me as being kind of suffocating. It's like, this is, if you don't live up to this, then you're dishonoring love, or you're not experiencing it, or you're, and, it's just always, for me, that's always kind of been the way that struck me. It's so flowery. It's so wonderful. It's just like,
this poem is flowery too.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, you know, if you don't have the something of Cyclops, blah, 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 you know.
Well, yeah, it just, you know, he's saying that he's not gonna take anybody who hasn't had this experience. That's kind of what it sounds like.
Mm.
He's not gonna take anybody, no matter how big or how fast or how persuasive of tongue, if that person is either not able to or has not yet, you know, done in the end. I don't know, Paul. Question I get with Paul is, has this man experienced that kind of love? Because he writes about, in my feeling, he writes about it as somebody who has not experienced it but wants to. It's more of an aspiration than an experience. But, and I don't know anybody who's grown up who's put away childhood joy into this completely. When I was I became an adult and I put away, put it into childish ways. I'm like, I don't know.
Well, I think that's a sort of a shout out to a poem about being a man.
Is it?
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of a.
There's sort of a man up kind of.
Yeah.
Man up, get the love.
Yeah.
It's a very. Reflected message.
Yeah.
Because when you think of, you know, ideals of love, childlike, unconditional love is sort of like the effect, but this is like, you know, you need to get some.
Cojones.
Cojones, yes, that's us. Man up in love.
Yeah, it completely changes. And what kind of love is Paul talking about here? I mean, right before this, he's, you know, the one body with many members. What kind of love is Paul talking about here? In the context of riffing on this poem.
But he's talking about a love that's kind of lived in very practical ways in the context of life together in a community. Right previously he's talking about the one body, many members, and then after this he's talking about how people have different gifts of prophecy, but if it's not serving the kind of the well-being of the whole, then it's, I don't care how many like fancy kind of spiritual tricks you have, it's not really that important if it's not governed by love.
Yes.
So it's, and which, you know, also makes me think that maybe connects to the military stuff too. In the sense that so the military is about kind of being part of a sort of different sort of community, right? That has its own kind of internal structures and values and goals, and so yeah. And so Paul's talking about a different kind of community that has love at its center.
Yeah, you're not bound by power structures or over against the other or diminishing the other so that you can kill them.
Right.
Yeah, you're talking about being in a community where not you sacrifice the other, but you have there's self-sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Other thoughts?
Gone down to 12, for now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know in part, and I still think of that love that I think, you know, that Sir Isaac Newton supposedly was the first one to define gravity, but I think the love that Aristotle meant that keeps the planets in orbit is his way of describing love as gravity, and it's there, and it is, and we as humans can appreciate it, who understands love as gravity? It just hit me that it's like the grace of God that is there, but how am I to my fellow human beings able to offer that same love that's like gravity, no matter what? Realistically, I'm not, and it's something though. How do you look for something and try to attain it, and yet not continually feel that you failed? That's the question I now ask myself.
I think Paul's saying here, this is not, this is not a disembodied love. This is the love of people trying to figure out church together. But I think Paul recognizes with that dimly thing, I don't know, that we just have to sort of live within the brokenness for a while. And you know, it's a little bit like gravity. You just jump and trust that you're going to land. You know, that there's a certain element of trust.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, you know, this is post-crucifixion and resurrection story, and so, you know, you could see that where, you know, the Roman Empire is what killed Christ. And then the ultimate disempowering of the empire was the crucifixion and resurrection of all the rules of power over, of, you know, of murder, of trying to attain, you know, what we want by hurting others. Everything was undone within the context. Because some of you probably know this, but the Paul's letters were written prior to the Gospels story. So it's pretty fresh in their minds. A other thoughts? What about other parts of Romans that, or parts of, I'm here, like, just kidding. What about other parts of Paul that just, you go, the Christ hymn, for example, oh, what is her name? It's in Philippians, but there was a woman writer of the time, and I should have, Sapphos. And she wrote, like, love stories, like those bodice ripper love stories, you know?
Love stories. Yes.
Love stories. Anyway, the Christ hymn, there's a poem she wrote, and it's just a complete riff on Sappho's poetry, and it's really great. It's really a funny parody of it. And I should have brought that too, but there's all these different funny things that Paul's doing, his arguments that. So, of course, it drives me crazy when people take Paul out of context because I'm like, that's not funny. You know, it's like taking Stephen Colbert out of context 2,000 years later and, that's not what he's trying to say. Not that I know what all Paul's trying to say, but they found this poem all over the place. I mean, they found this military poem. It's all over, it's a gazillion copies of it still today.
Still in chapter 13, 13th verse there at the very end, I'm curious how people take that ordering there, if people make a lot of the faith, hope, and love, is 1, 2, 3, is it like the greatest is love, so that gets the capstone there, but how people understand, like, the relationship of faith, hope, is he saying, like, is that just kind of, are those kind of tossed off, like, faith, hope, and love, or... is there something like really kind of pointed he's saying by those three and that they're in that order?
I don't know, what do you think?
I don't know.
Because I don't think you can have one without the other. Mm-hmm. I mean, once you kind of not get the love thing, but once you've been broken open by Christ, sometimes I just like cry when I do, preside over communion because it's like so. Everyone is fed. Everyone's known. And yet it's very particular to the person, but it's also the whole community. And I just wonder if once you kind of get it, because it's not something that we can conjure up, I think, ourselves, but once. Doesn't the others come? I don't know.
All these can be kind of transient for humans in some ways. I mean, you can feel like you can grow some faith, hope, and even love. And for God, I don't think I associate hope and faith with God and love. I mean, that's love. We don't talk about God's faith or hope.
That's interesting.
So, and then also, I think it's in the context of if this is, let's say, a separate Stephen Colbert episode or skit.
Yeah.
He's gonna, he's riffing on love.
Yeah.
So of course, love's the greatest in this piece right here. I mean, he's talking about faith later. Faith's number one.
And then there's grace. All these things.
Huh.
Hope is number one here.
Judy, you were going to say
something. Well, just for fun, I did hear a sermon once by Dick Elvey at Gustavus, and he said, faith, hope, and love abide these three, and the greatest of these is hope. It just kind of shook everybody. But it was that he was making that point.
I think of it as having worked in the arts and had an ex-husband who was in the sciences and had having had a son when I got a PhD in physics, that there are a lot of people that have faith in their ability and hope to get a good academic position, and they publish a lot, but if they don't love what they're doing, the other stuff doesn't come to as much fruit as somebody who may be less gifted, but is in love with what they're doing.
Oh, it's so true. I mean, you know, my favorite college professors and seminary professors and all the professors I have, the ones that you just loved, I mean, that you just were like, were the ones who had a passion for what they were. You could tell that just came. They were just like, you couldn't stop talking about it.
It seems that it's kind of, it's almost desert-like if there's no love, even though there may be faith in the ability and faith in the outcome and good and reason to hope, that it lacks a wellspring.
Yeah, it lacks light. Other thoughts?
I find this passage really encouraging. I kind of, as you were reading it, my feeling about it was it talks about God's love for us, and that to the extent that we can be open to God's love for us, we can share that with other people.
Mm.
And there's something about that in the now we see in the mirror dimly, you know, something about how. Something in that about how it can be difficult for us to be open to God's love for us. And I see, you know, I see myself in the child role in that respect. And so it's in, you know, it's kind of ties into the thing about gravity too, that, you know, if you let yourself open to that or kind of fall into that, that you will be pulled toward that.
Right. Yeah.
I have
a couple thoughts, but don't know if the words will attach to the thoughts. But you mentioned that in battle, at that time, there wasn't guns. You weren't far away from the person you were battling with,
mm-hmm.
face to face.
Very intimate.
And so in battle, that poem was referring to face to face, that virtue is attained there. And he is talking about the face-to-face line, that in faith as well, we may not see each other clearly, but we are face-to-face in this.
Mm. Oh,
in the
that's nice.
Faith journey. And that last line of faith, hope, and love, I think that when he's doing what he does, which makes you kind of listen with your mouth hanging open because it's kind of, you're trying to catch up as he's going, what he's going for. He does bring it around in the end with whatever words to sort of make people say, oh, okay, you just woke me up to that situation, and now that, yes, there's something we need to deal with. But, you know, it's sort of a wake up. But yet, it's not hopeless. I think what he does is sort of points out things so that we realize there's work to be done, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's here, Paul, he's writing in such a way, and he's sort of saying, yeah, well, this is love, and none of you are doing it, really. You know?
Right.
You're not doing it, but at the end, it says, it sort of says, oh, love isn't envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. Okay, yeah, we all passed that mark.
Not.
And so it kind of makes us kind of go, oh, we're not there. But at the end, there is faith, there is hope, and that love is part of that mix, and you go forward into that unknown dim mirror that you can't totally define with good courage or whatever. And so I don't know, something about it. He kind of pulls you apart, but pulls you together again at the end.
Yeah.
With that.
Yeah, I mean, it is the battle imagery, I think, that he uses this poem is really pretty brilliant. The way he uses the sort of intimacy and the face-to-face stuff and does it at the same time.
Yeah. But in the end.
In the end.
In a battle scene, you come back as a victorious, a virtuous.
Right.
And in the end, you come into faith and hope and... If there is love, yes, you've gained something. I mean, actually, he sort of says there is something to keep going forward with, even though the whole thing's kind of challenging you to do it. I mean,
but the winning is so different from the winning of battle.
Yeah.
But do you get virtue just by killing your opponents face to face, or by understanding the consequences and the reasoning for why you did that?
No, there's no, in the poem itself, there's no, it's just going in and be able to look at, like,
the bravery.
To see you coming at me right now, and we get closer, so we have to, you know, be close, and I can still look you in the eye and stab you. That's virtue.
So he says.
I'm going to say quite a bit of this,
you know, this is...
No, but, yeah, it's...
This is the great scam of military involvement. If you can't get your soldiers to go forth and kill, then you are not going to be a very successful seeker of empire or whatever it is. And,
no, exactly.
And you know, historically, you can see through the ages this same theme is applied to bring everybody into a mode where they're ready to go out and kill for the Gipper, and you know, you have your signs of it. You have the red badge of courage in the Civil War. You have the scarf on your face in the for the Prussian soldiers. But then, if you read what some of these people who have survived this have to say about it, they say we were fooled. And the applicability here to me, I've always tried to think of what is the context that Paul has in mind here, and right at the beginning he says, I hear you people have been fighting.
Yes.
With one another.
Yes.
Good
point, Len.
You know, and he goes hither and yon through this whole chapter, but I kind of think that this bit about love is kind of bringing it home to roost. That you can stand up and be as faithful in appearances and even believe that you are fully faithful, but if you are going to turn around in the next breath and curse your neighbor, then you don't have it. You haven't figured this out yet. And so to me, that's sort of where he's going with this story. I don't know if that's really what other people think, but...
No, there's a lot of, you know, now that, since they find more of these ancient documents and things like this, and then biblical scholars are able to say, oh, you know, it's, but I mean, if you're promised 10 virgins by being a suicide bomber, and you're 17-year-old boy, you know, and that's like, you could fit, you know. Yeah. You can argue it. You can argue it. I mean, you're not going to argue that with a, you know, probably a 45-year-old man. They're like, I know I might die. I know I'm going to die. But yeah, you can convince young men of a lot of things. That's why we sent young men off to war, because even developmentally, their brains don't fully understand that they're going to die.
There's a man in our coffee group who made the remark that because any kind of pornography, any kind of seeing of, and you can't even see most women's faces, and now a lot of them don't have the money to get married because they have to have dowries in most of those countries. that there is no way to siphon off this energy, and that the people who want to recruit them as suicide bombers have this sexual deprivation that aids it.
I don't know how helpful that is to the understanding of this text, but I mean, there are a lot of different bombers and such. You know, Paul uses a lot of military language throughout his writings. It was one of the rhetorical topics. It was, you know.
What is it where you put on the armor thing? That's another one of his military things where he riffs on all that stuff. But you put on a different kind of armor of, you know.
Right. The armor of Christ, the full armor of Christ.
Yeah.
And such. And, you know, I mean, it's one of the ways that he connects to his readers.
Mm-hmm. But it's very clever. It's very smart. I mean, that's why I love watching Stephen Colbert, because he takes the most sort of off the wall things and then, you know, switches them over so that you're like, oh, it's brilliant. You know, it's pretty brilliant. I think Paul's just brilliant. And he's able to, you know, he really knows his stuff. He's a smart guy. He's a really educated guy. And so he could take Snooki from Jersey Shore and probably do something really, really brilliant with him. Snooki like Jesus.
Go.
Any other thoughts before we close?
Maybe we've come a little far in our moral evolution, because now I doubt at this time that there were any books like the one compiled after the Vietnam War called The Courage Not to Fight, and the documenting what many of the people went through who decided they weren't going to go, and showing what courage that took. The fact that we now have books like that, that probably there was nothing in the literature of that time.
No, I don't know. You know, I don't know that. I know Paul is speaking in that way. I mean, Paul's trying to do that, but I don't know.
Just before we close, I was just thinking, thinking about this poem and this military image, looking the person in the eye and having the virtue to stab them in the heart. So that's a obviously a really terrifying scenario for any of us to imagine, right? So if Paul is engaging in some sort of critique and kind of parody of that, the Christian parody would be to have someone coming at you with a knife to stab you in the heart and to love them, right?
Yeah.
That becomes the Christian response to that, which, again, is terrifying.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
I think that truly, truly loving someone, we die.
Mm-hmm.
There's a death of ourselves. Which I think leads perfectly into 10:30, Judy's talk on community. Okay. Natural time. Like, what does it mean?
I just listen.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you think about things like being face-to-face and you think about, like, well, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think Jen wrote in her email is the importance of being unplugged from all our gadgetry. And we do so many things not face-to-face. I mean, I take care of most of my job not being face-to-face with people anymore. I mean, emails, phone calls, you know, Facebook. So when we talk about community, what does that, this first. I think there's a natural time for people are like, I mean, be face to face. I want someone in the eye.
Good, I hope you'll come.
I'm coming on it. Any other last thoughts before we close? Let's say the Lord's Prayer together, and we'll just do the traditional version. Our Father, who art in heaven,
hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
Go in peace, serve the Lord.
Nice to meet you.